Greetings and welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we're featuring an interview with saxophonist extraordinaire, Terry Sonny Littritt, as well as cuts from his new CD, Huber Lake Sessions, his contributions on the new recordings from Upside Down and Backwards, plus a live in-studio performance. So let's get to the interview. Sonny Lee, Terry Tripp, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Wow, thanks, Jim.
Glad you made it out here and found yourself in the cornfields.
Yeah, I just hope I can make my my way back home.
Right. So let's go way back to the beginning. How did you get started? Was the saxophone your first instrument?
No, and it wasn't my most serious instrument for sure. I wanted to play trumpet. I was 9 years old. My dad went to a garage sale and found a clarinet for $5. Came home and told me I was playing clarinet. And I started in beginning band in Hazelcrest, Illinois. And I was very fortunate to have started under the leadership of Adeline Anderson, who has become a legend, not only in the Midwest, but probably across the nation as a band director. And she was tough. She expected a lot, and I think that that's how I got my start, and I think that's what's kept my attitude maybe at that level, to improve, to practice, to pay attention, sit up straight, you know,
right,
be
right.
On time,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Well, that's important, I mean, especially to get a foundation like that,
mm-hmm.
You know. From there, where did you go?
Then I went to, she started me on saxophone,
mm-hmm.
Also. I remember solo contest. I was playing a clarinet solo, and she asked the band during one rehearsal, does anybody else want to play a solo? And I put my hand up, and she said, but you already have one. And she says, well, I want to do one on saxophone, too. And she said, you better learn the one on clarinet before you even think about it. That gives you a clue on
right.
her leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And she was right. You know, I hadn't learned that clarinet piece yet. So needless to say, I only played the clarinet solo that year. But went to Thornton High School. That back in the day when there was no surrounding high schools. And Thornton was quite the school. Band program, orchestra program, athletic department was strong. I think our graduating class was 1,200.
And what year would this have been?
Well, that would have been 62, from 62 to 66.
So was that at the same time the Dells were?
Yes.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I was in the basement. The Dells, Vern Ryan, had wanted to add horns, and why he picked this little blonde-headed, toe-headed kid in high school to come play, but he did. And I remember rehearsing with the Dells rhythm section and a couple of singers in this funky old basement in Harvey.
Wow.
Sometime between 1962 and 1966.
And they were still sort of in their developing years, too?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right. They really hadn't had any major success.
Yeah.
You know, just local. Yeah, but it was a great high school experience. The level of everything at that time was very high. And Eugene Johnson was my band director. Mr. Campbell, can't remember his first name, was my orchestra director. I played violin in high school
wow.
also.
And then at what point did the Newports come about?
Newports, for me, I think they were playing, they didn't have a horn player the first year or two, maybe 1963, 64, and then for the next two or three years, a lot of teen hops
mm-hmm.
and field house gigs and...
So the Newports after many years have sort of Bill Bilby put the band back together and you guys are performing again.
Right. After 40 some years, we, I think it was at our 45th reunion, he got the band back together to play for that. And that was about 5-6 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And, that was, I guess, gave Bill the idea that, oh, that sounded pretty good.
Right.
And, you know, I had been playing with a band out of Northwest Indiana, the Scamp Band, for, 15 years, I think I was with them. And one of the lead singers, Mark Rogers, got a hold of Gene Norrie, who was the drummer for Scamp. And we did some gigs with some of the horn players that were playing back in high school, but mm-hmm. hadn't played since high school. And kind of got the Newports back together with a couple of the Scamp members, including myself. And, a keyboard player from high school, too. But he had kept on playing. You know, his chops were real strong.
Well, I had the pleasure of playing, filling in a guitar for one of those gigs, and it seemed like there was some people who went from high school, went on to other avenues, and then some guys had stayed with music like yourself.
Right.
The one, was it Tom Donlinger, played with Van Morrison.
Right.
And was a professional musician.
Right.
Another guy was in a band called Aorta.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting to get some professional musicians with some of the high school guys. I mean, it seems like a phenomenon, like people are, baby boomers are retiring or the kids are out of the house and they go back and pick up their instrument and kind of try to pick up where they left off.
Exactly. And for them, I mean, they're just as excited as they can be. You know, they're so happy to be playing again. Like you said, the baby boomers, and we're in our 50s and 60s and getting close to that 70 mark, to be doing anything, performing, is really a kick for them.
Yeah.
And it's good to see. It's kind of a nice feeling, you know, when we play, to see them enjoying it so much. You know, where those of us that have continued playing all these years, maybe we take the fun or the excitement, maybe we kind of forget about
The joy
of playing, and that's been a real nice feeling with the Newports coming back like that.
Sure. So from high school, then you had the Newports, and then you went on to college?
I went to the U of I in Champaign, majored in music education, and I'm so thankful I did because it allowed me to take a teaching job when I needed to support my family at home. My father was handicapped and lived on my grandmother, who raised me, lived on her real small Social Security. And so I was able to get that degree, and I found a teaching job as soon as I got out of college. And I was able to help our family make it.
Right.
You know, have food on the table and pay all the bills and things like that. And so I was, some of my mentors early on said, you want to get that education degree.
Smart.
You know, so what? And my attitude was, no, I'm going to be a professional musician. And I probably felt that way for maybe a decade. Maybe I wished that if I didn't have to teach, I could be, you know, exploring other avenues and getting, you know, moving up the ladder.
Right.
But as it turns out, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me was getting that ed degree and keeping my nose clean and to the grindstone teaching.
And you performed throughout
your
teaching career. Yeah.
Burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah.
You know.
And we talked about the joy of playing. So there's certain joys of being a teacher and seeing some of the students really grow. And have you had any students that have become musicians? And
Yeah. None that I could say maybe are nationally known, but you know, like me, they're playing around.
Right.
You know,
but we did a gig recently with Jeff James. Jeff was a student? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did a student teaching with me when I was at Patton School in Riverdale. And I put in 28 years there. I had put in 7 years in Hazelcrest. And so that was my 35 years, and I took my retirement 2 years early.
Mm-hmm.
So that I could not burn the candle at both ends and do more playing.
Get some sleep and do some gigs.
Right, and do some gigs.
So what about, as a teacher, I mean, is there anything that you've learned as a teacher from the students?
Definitely. I think the biggest thing is that every person is an individual. Each person learns possibly different than the next. And I think the job of a teacher is to find out what works for as many individuals as possible. Not, okay, I have 30 kids. Here, kids, this is how you're going to learn it, and that's it. If you don't learn it, too bad. You know, here's your F. Here's your D. And I think that comes from taking private lessons as a musician. That one-on-one, you know, and I've tried to apply that to any of my private teaching. What I present to one student might not be the same as the next student.
Sure.
You know, the left brain, right brain,
right.
middle brain, all that stuff. It's true.
So you mentioned Scamp Band. You've also played with a number of groups, the Calumet Brothers, and
currently I play with the Calumet Brothers, some young boys out of Northwest Indiana called Upside Down and Backwards, Ryan Fromm, Derek Carrillo, outstanding young upstarts, very talented, and it's blues R&B,
mm-hmm.
which is where I'm probably most comfortable, and where I do my best playing.
So you're sort of the mentor, the elder statesman in that group?
Well, yes. I'll take that title. I don't know. Ask them, and
right.
they'll say, that old fart. But no, they show me a lot of respect, and they do listen. But, you know, I'm not beyond the point where I don't learn from young people.
Right.
The key is listening.
Yeah,
you know, which
in listening in life or listening musically. I mean,
both.
You have to pay attention, and mm-hmm. You've done some recording with them.
Yes, I did. They did a demo CD, and I was able to play on that one instrumental that features me, called Mr. Blues.
Let's take a listen to that.
Okay. We'll be right back.
So that was Sonny Lee with Upside Down and Backwards. How about these other groups that you work with, the Saxophones or TNT? Can you talk about those groups?
Oh, yeah. You know, many years ago, my friend Barry Spurdy, a wonderful singer and saxophonist, he and I would be hanging out, and we'd go to some jam sessions. And we went to a bar, which is now called Bottoms Up in Lansing. Mm-hmm. But back then it was called something else, and I can't remember the name of it. But
McKinney's. Was it McKinney's? I think it's one of those places that had a few names.
Right. I think its nickname was the Bucket of Blood. But anyway, we're sitting there on a jam night, and it was a million guitar players and fiddle players, and we started ragging on guitar players. You know, there's too many guitar players around here. You know, we ought to start a band with nothing but saxophones. And we didn't think nothing about it, and we probably played a little bit that night on something. A lot of it was country music, so saxophone, of course, doesn't have a large role in country. But anyway, I don't know how many years later, Barry called me on the phone. He said, "You remember that night we got a little snockered up and we were bad-mouthing guitar players and said, we're going to start a band with nothing but saxophones?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Let's do it." And we met, and we decided that we're going to have three saxophone players up front and a rhythm section, and we were going to do all saxophone classics and R&B tunes that feature the saxophone, like a few of Junior Walker's mm-hmm. tunes, you know, Shotgun and What Does It Take and things like that. So we put a few sets together, and we put the band to work, and we played for many years together, mainly festivals and not too many bars. It wasn't really a bar band. It was more of a special event kind of a band.
It's a great concept.
Yeah, and we were playing between 20 and 30 gigs a year, a lot of Park District concerts mm-hmm. during the summer. And we kept that going, and the agent that we used kept us busy, and he closed up shop and moved to Hollywood and went big time. And so we didn't really handle the business end of it and do much booking. So it kind of dwindled mm-hmm. out.
And what about TNT?
Now, TNT is another special event band. You know, it's nine pieces, and 90% of the music is Tower Power. And Lou Corelli is the fellow who's written all the charts, and he's excellent. You know, he's lifted all their music and written charts. And we've got five horn players and full rhythm section, you know, with keys mm-hmm. and a lead singer. And once again, a special event, corporate events. If we played the bars, we'd be making about $10-$20 a piece.
Right.
And the band is special, you know, so it should be playing special events.
Right.
So maybe four, five, six jobs a year is about it. It's an exciting band to hear and listen.
How would you characterize Scamp Band? What kind of stuff do you guys play?
A cover band, mm-hmm. top 40 cover band. You know, and they could cover a lot because we had two keyboard stations, traditional grand piano, electric grand piano, mm-hmm. and Hammond organ with a Leslie. And then my keyboard station was all the synth parts for layering. And a lot of the music in the 80s, you know, was that techno pop with a lot of synth things happening.
Yeah.
So we were able to cover a lot. And that band worked three nights a week forever, you know. Finally, after a while, I just was burned out, you know, with the bar scene mm-hmm. and all that. And I missed playing big band jazz and other styles of music. And so I left that scene. And ironically, the Scamp Band is a four piece. We were seven pieces back then. I was playing again. Now,
right, you're back, yeah.
In this decade, you know, as a four-piece. Sometimes we'll add people, you know, add a fifth and sixth, like Mark Rogers' son, Zeke.
Yeah.
Will come in. And
great talent.
Yeah, another great talent. His whole family.
Yeah.
You know.
So you're talking about jazz, playing jazz bands. You have a new record out that's wonderful. I really enjoyed it. And can you talk about, was the Huber Lake Sessions? Is that the name of the record?
Yeah, Huber Lake Sessions. John Huber's recording studio is called Spot. And John Huber is the technician. And he's put a lot of money and thought, and he's got a wonderful facility, which he's enlarged this past year. He's going to make it also a video production facility. And while I was playing every Wednesday night, and I was teaching at South Suburban College, teaching a few courses and playing with the jazz orchestra, which was a community jazz orchestra. So you had band directors from the area and professional musicians who've retired or, you know, just wanting to play. And it got to a real, real high level, and I started getting some of my jazz chops back together. And the lead trombone player, Charles Cosgrove, I call him Charlie, magnificent jazz trombonist. He and I kind of locked horns and liked playing with one another and off one another. And so he called me one day and said, you know, he fell into some money, and he said he would pay for the recording of a CD if I would do the arranging. And so that's what we did. We together, we put our heads together and came up with the tunes that we'd like to do. And I wrote the arrangements. He did a couple. On the CD, there's a trombone ballad. And in the background, you'll hear a whole trombone section. Well, he played all the parts.
Nice.
And yeah, it was great. It was great. It reminded me that if I ever set my sights on becoming a jazz artist, I don't think I would have had time to do anything else in life.
Right.
Yeah, because it's such a demanding art form.
But, you know, I've always known you as an R&B and soul and blues and rock player.
Yeah.
So to hear the record, I think it's just a fantastic record. It was nice to hear you play jazz.
Yeah. Charlie would say, you know, I kept saying, Charlie, you know, I'm just not a strong jazz player. And he said, yeah, but that's what I'm looking for. I've got all that jazz stuff, but you've got all the, you know, the barbecue sauce.
Yeah,
stuff.
Got the soul.
And he said, together, but when we play together in unison or in harmony, our tones matched nicely.
Uh-huh.
And he said the contrast between the two he liked. So I said, okay, let's go.
And you've written material for that record too?
Yeah, I think I have maybe only one. Some Kind of Mood, which I originally wrote for large jazz orchestra. So I wrote it for just trombone and tenor. Quite a watering down, but it was just a melodic thing, and it was easy to do. You know, we just needed nice chords, and it could have stood by itself. I could have played it alone.
Right.
You know, and
so that's called
Some Kind of Mood.
So let's listen to Some Kind of Mood.
Cool. Thank you.
So you wrote and arranged Some Kind of Mood. Where do you find your inspiration?
Inspiration.
I'll give you an example. I was working on an instrumental, and I wanted one more verse, and I was just struggling with this melody. And I was sitting on my back porch, and I heard these birds, and they were going. I got it from the birds. The birds showed up and gave me the rest of the song. I mean, so sometimes it comes through nature. Sometimes it comes through the clickety-clack of your car. Or sometimes it just shows up like, you know, Immaculate Conception, right? It just sometimes a melody, you know, you wake up in the morning and you have a melody in your head and you think, did I steal that? Where did that come from?
You know what? Nothing like that has ever happened to me. I don't have a clue. A real strong clue, yeah. Anyway, to where inspiration comes from, other than I just always had a thing about creating something, of course, with music, caused me to start writing and arranging the challenge that it presented. And the great joy that it gives you,
right,
when it's done and you perform it or record it, I think maybe that's the incentive, was to always to reach for another experience like that.
Yeah,
and I know I'm sure things happened in life along all the years that I used to write some songs lyrically, you know, mm-hmm. write some lyrics. And I know each one of those things were based on something, an event in my life. But instrumentally, I don't know how that transfers.
I think sometimes that the lyric may lend itself to a melody. Right? Mm-hmm. If somebody says, I went downtown today, you can go, I went downtown today. And then you have
there's
your melody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And then sometimes it just organically goes from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think so.
I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about songwriting where they say you're an antenna and just stuff just comes to you or other people that say that a song that maybe it took you 3 minutes to write, it actually took you 30 years to write because it's been germinating around your brain for mm-hmm. that long, and it just in the 30 seconds it finally showed up.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I just recently went in the old suitcase and pulled out some things from 20 and 30 years ago that I had been working on, and kind of got a fresh, you know, feeling about it, and started writing it out for a small group, maybe even, you know, the jazz orchestra when I was with them.
That's cool to revisit old ideas, you know. Sometimes you just hit a brick wall, and then you come back
mm-hmm.
however much later,
mm-hmm.
and it's still there.
It's like meeting a good friend that you had after 20 or 30 years, and you see them, and you go, oh, my gosh. You know, it's kind of a neat experience.
Pick it up right where you left off.
Yeah, for sure.
And we've had the pleasure of performing together and recording together, and you made a statement one time that it's like we live on the same street. Or that our mothers knew each other, and
your mother and my mother were both mothers.
That's right. And I like that, and you know, to me it was a compliment. But I think it also kind of said we're maybe coming from the same place, somewhat musically,
mm-hmm.
you know, or sure. we're walking down the same, you know, path together.
Yeah. The other one was we went to different schools together.
Right.
Yeah. Now, both of those I have to give credit to Ronnie Kirk, who was the lead guitarist with Scamp.
Uh-huh.
He had a million of those.
Right.
But those were two that stuck in my mind that I would use. And I'll take credit for it.
Yeah. Well, you can relate to it, you know.
Yeah.
For sure. You know.
Some Northwest Indiana singers, Chad Burton, Robbie Celestin. I've written the horns for their originals, their original CDs mm-hmm. that they've made. And with Robbie Celestin, he does an original music show maybe 4 or 5 times a year, and I'll play on those shows.
But didn't you do some work with some like bands at the Holiday Star?
Yeah, the Dusty shows, we called them. The Ferris brothers, Omar and Charlie, they would produce these Dusty shows where they'd put like in one night, one concert, they'd have the Coasters, the Drifters, Lou Christie, Leslie Gore, maybe the Temptations, Little Anthony and the Imperials, Duke.
Oh, Gene Chandler.
Gene Chandler. Yeah. Frankie Ford, C. Cruz.
Yeah.
Just on and on. He'd put different combinations together. And I never wrote any of the music. Some of them had horn charts sure. already from years past. But through Barry Spurdy, who had a connection with Omar and Charlie. Charlie was with Stormy Weather, the doo-wop group.
Okay.
Through Barry, he included me in the horn section that they requested. And so we'd go for rehearsal during the day and then play the show at night.
Any interesting stories about some of those personalities?
Let me see. I don't know why this sticks in my mind. Probably because I have the picture of this woman in my garage. But Martha Reeves, yeah. Martha and the Vandellas, played a bunch of shows with her, not only on the Dusties thing, but on shows where it was just her on the show. But anyway, the one time she was handing out autographed pictures. And so, I went in and I said, Martha, I'd like to have one. And so she writes on the picture, Sonny loves Martha. Which was not the case.
Was not the case.
No. Martha is notorious for not being not the easiest person to work for.
Okay.
And that I suppose that's an interesting story. I don't know.
So Lou Christie, I think of that high voice, two faces have I. And what I found incredible is a lot of these artists, even into their 70s and 80s, they still have that
still
voice.
Still do it, yeah.
I saw Billy Paul recently. Mm-hmm. Still got that great voice.
Yeah.
And I guess we hope that we can still have our instrument together when we're older.
Yes, older. We won't put a number on it.
All right, right.
Yeah, for sure. And, I was fortunate to play. We were on an Ohio tour. Cincinnati, Cleveland, Dayton. Cleveland was the last one, and it was the grand opening of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And we were down in the pit, and I didn't know that the stage revolved because it goes so slow.
Right.
If you're not mindful, you don't notice it's moving. But I noticed because I'm reading the music for the first group, and before I looked down on my music, the guy was facing me. And then I'm playing, and then all of a sudden I see nothing but butts.
What happened there?
So, it was, because it had revolved.
Yeah.
Theater in the round kind of thing.
Well, how about the saxophone you have here with you today? Do you have a number of saxophones, or can you talk about the instrument?
No, it's kind of a, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of a thing. This mouthpiece I've been playing for almost 40 years. A lot of guys will go through, every 5 years, 10 years, want to change their mouthpiece to get a different sound or improve their sound. But this is the first Proline metal saxophone mouthpiece that I ever bought, and been playing it ever since. This is this particular horn is the Selmer Mark VI, which is it's the Stratocaster of the saxophone family. And I was going to get my son fell into some money, and he was going to buy me a new horn because the Mark VI I had previous to this was just totally tarnished and patinaed. So I went to Brasswind Woodwind, and I asked for every pro horn. So I had like six horns in there, mm-hmm. plus mine. And I had my son go outside of the studio. I said, I'm going to play all six horns, and I want you to tell me which one was the best. Played all six horns. He was going to buy me a horn.
Kind of a blind taste test.
Right. Yeah. And he said, I choose number six. That was my old, that was my old beat
worked
up.
Out for him. Right.
And I said, dang. So I didn't get the new horn. I just continued to play that old Mark VI.
Was there something about the feel, you know, of a horn? You know, if you, it's like driving someone else's car, like it just feels right in your hands, that kind
yeah.
of thing?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, summer was, I mean, if you had 1,000 professional saxophonists, probably 900 and some odd would be playing a Selmer Mark VI or a 7 or some of their other models that they came out with.
We did a show, and Mark mentioned how you got the name Sonny Lee. Can you tell me that story?
Well, I was playing after college. I ended up playing with a huge band that was supposed to be like the group Chicago times five.
Okay.
So they had 10, you know, how many horns did we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 or 9 horn players. And the producer's idea was that, okay, if they can make that kind of sound with 3, just think what we can do with 9. So that band was called Jumbo. And it later, when it kind of got much smaller, they were still playing, I found out, under the name Buster. And people out of Chicago might remember them. They were kind of popular. And we did one album. And after a while, I left. I just was disenchanted with what I was doing. And I remember to getting a cab on Wabash. Our studio was above Frank's Drum Shop
mm-hmm.
on Wabash Avenue. And that was my last rehearsal. I packed up, and I don't know how I got there, but I didn't have a car. Don't remember. But got a taxi, and I said, is there any live jazz nearby? And at that time in Marina City, there was a little bar on the first floor, and L.D. Young, who was with Young Holt Unlimited.
Right. Played with Ramsey Lewis?
Yes. Yeah. And their big crossover hit was The In Crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's who was playing at this little place he dropped me off at. And I had my saxophone case, and I just sat in a corner, and I was in heaven listening to it.
Sure.
And they took a break, and the drummer, Shante Hamilton, he came over, and he said, you're a musician, I take it. And I said, yeah, I'm a saxophonist. And he said, well, why don't you come up and play some? And I said, oh, no, you know, I couldn't. But it didn't take much to
sure.
talk me into
right.
it. Yeah. And it's been so long, I don't know the exact things that were said. But I ended up playing with them. I probably played the rest of the night.
Yeah. You know?
And L.D. Young was such a magnificent person. He, I was like 21, 22. He kind of mentored me, you know. And I wasn't a member of the band, but I was a permanent guest or sitter-inner.
Like an honorary member.
Right.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of nice experiences with them for a few years. One most memorable was at the Back Room on Rush Street, which was a pretty popular jazz bar at the time. And a lot of jazz artists who played at the Jazz Showcase and the Happy Medium would come there afterwards. So one night, the blind saxophonist Roland Kirk,
mm-hmm.
who was notorious for playing like multi-instruments in his
sure.
mouth at the same time, and keep in mind he was blind. And LD knew him, and so during the break, he went over, and I could see him talking. And anyway, so I said, okay, we're going back up. Sonny, come on. I said, okay. And I knew Roland Kirk was out there. Anyway, and I said, oh, by the way, what did Roland Kirk have to say? He said, oh, he wanted to know who the white tenor player was.
Right.
It took me a moment. I was thinking and thinking. And I understood. You know. Now, the original question you asked me was,
how'd you get the name Sonny Lee?
Oh, so when I was playing down there with them,
yeah.
Some of my friends came in and saw me up there, and they announced me as Sonny Lee because the drummer one night said, Terry, that's just not a jazz name. That's not a cool name. He said, what's your middle name? I said, it's Lee. And he's going, Lee, Tritt, Lee, Sonny Lee. Sonny Lee, that's your new name. So they would announce me beforehand and sometimes after as Sonny Lee. And some of my friends came in and they said, you know, what's this Sonny Lee business?
Right,
you're going Hollywood on us? And I said, no, it wasn't even my choice. So the next group I played with was Scamp. And the guy who brought me in introduced me as Sonny Lee.
Stuck.
And not Terry.
The rest is history.
So everybody in Indiana knew me as Sonny. Everybody in Illinois knew me as Terry.
But it's almost like the fact that those cats called you Sonny Lee, like you had arrived and you'd been ordained and you got your own name and you're part of the club now, right?
Yeah, I think so. That's cool. Made me feel that way anyway.
Yeah. So you'd always sort of been had your feet in jazz at one point or another, right?
To a point, yeah. But it's probably more, I don't want to call it smooth jazz. I'd call it R&B, crossover, you know, R&B with jazz influence.
Sure.
Maybe.
Who would you cite as influence on the saxophone?
Well, I love Gene Ammons,
mm-hmm.
and Dexter Gordon. Those are my initial saxophonists that I listened to and felt close to. And of course I listened to, you know, all the ones that you're supposed to listen
right.
to.
Right.
You know, Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and
Dexter Gordon, there's a certain like sadness or melancholy that he has in his tone that
mm-hmm.
that I love.
Right. And speaking of Gene Ammons and L.D. Young, I was on 63rd and Cottage Grove, and L.D. had invited me to come to this night and play some. And sitting at the bar was Gene Ammons.
Wow.
With his hat on, full-length leather jacket, his horn in a leather bag strapped on his back, his head laid down on the bar because he was just wasted.
Right.
And he died a week or 10 days later. So I think I was one of the last people to play live when he was in the room. The disappointment was that I thought maybe I'd get to play with him.
Sure. Sonny, can you tell me about your very first professional gig?
I can. And I see images right now of this bar. Cape Cod on Burnham was my first professional gig with a band called People's Gas. I always think of the two go-go girls on each side of the stage. I mean, they still had go-go girls.
Yeah.
You know, with the boots and the tasseled skirts. And I was, 19? Man.
What kind of music? Were you playing boom, chicka, boom kind of stuff for the girls? Or what kind of music were you playing?
That was pretty much rock and roll of the day.
Uh-huh.
And see, this would have been 68, 69. So, I can't remember the music. I think it's because of those go-go girls.
Yeah, you were a little distracted.
I was. Anyway, and I remember the bar owner. I can see him coming up with his eyes as big as hubcaps. And he said, "Do not play that flute ever again in this bar." And I guess it was too spooky. He said, it's spooking people. It's freaking people out.
Wow. So they weren't used to the flute in the
no.
in the strip joints.
No. No. I remember going to a plane in a church in Gary, and one song would go for an hour, and it just kept, the excitement just kept escalating, and people were whooping each other with towels while they were stepping, mm-hmm. you know, doing these dances, and I was just, you know, I come out of a Lutheran church where, you know, pretty
straight. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And
so yeah. What about, you know, I think there's a big parallel between gospel music and soul music and mm-hmm. R&B. I mean, so did that experience in the church help you to play R&B?
I think the purity of a church choir and the melodic tunes, like Amazing Grace is still my favorite yeah. tune to play. You know, simple little church song that everybody in the world knows. I think that has always affected my tone and producing melody.
But what about like the spirit of the music?
I don't know. You know, I think I get the spirit from the players.
Yeah. So if the band is kicking it, you're on board.
Yeah, yeah. I'm ready.
All right, Sonny, what do you say we just play some blues?
All right, from the one. One, two, three.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.